it's October. It's still Oktoberfest, too, for those of you living in enjoying Oktoberfest in Munich. What is it? The last 2 weeks of September, the first 2 weeks of October is what they do in Europe. And yeah, I had my great time last week. Great fun. Tons of people. Had my Lederhosen on. And for those of you who don't believe that I had my Lederhosen on, you can go to the Facebook page, go to Facebook groups, Earth Ancient, and you can see me with my leather Lederhosen in full glory. They're not very comfortable. For those of you who have worn Lederhosen, when you first get them, I've had those, the pair that you see in that image, that photo, I've had those for about 6 years. But when I first got them, it's like they're not really tanned. They're not really treated with anything. They're just like cut out of cowhide and then sewn together. So they're really not really comfortable. So I guess that's just, I mean, they're authentic. That's what they do. That's how they wear them. They wear, you know, like the farmers of Bavaria. So it was fun. It's a good time. Hey, I've mentioned I'm going to be in Paris. We're going to be flying to Paris and then over to Barcelona right after the holidays. We're flying out of San Francisco on the 26th of December. And I just wanted you to know that I'm very frugal when it comes to traveling. I try to find the best prices and to fly, and the cheapest places to stay. And I have to tell you, this phenomenon known as Airbnb is really cool, because basically people have flats, they have rooms, and in some cases you can just rent a bed if you're in a location someplace in the world. And I had a friend that traveled throughout Europe, basically stayed in Airbnb homes. These are homes that people open up, and in some cases they have an apartment, a complete apartment with a full kitchen, bath, bed, all the conveniences of home, and they rent these spaces out. And the cool thing about Airbnb, like I mentioned, is you can either rent a full apartment, you can rent a room with a bed in it and a bath, or you can just rent a bed. So it has three levels of pricing. I found that on average, I can get between 20 to 40% off or a percent off of what you would normally pay for a hotel. And like I said, I'm going to be in Paris. So Paris average hotels in the central area, the central quarter where the Eiffel Tower is and all the great museums were, which is where we're going to go. Those hotels are about 150 US per night. And that doesn't include food either. So we're going to do Airbnb, and I'm really looking forward to it because I've traveled and stayed in homes in Portland, and I've stayed in a couple other places where people open their homes, and we've had great luck staying in places. We've been really fortunate, and I'm just really excited because when you go to the website, Airbnb.com, you check out, you can see what the place looks like, a ton of reviews, and they actually give you the amenities, you know, if it has a kitchen, or if it has a bathroom, has a tub, does it have a washer and dryer, which is really important if you're traveling a lot, if you want to, you know, you get a washer and dryer going. And actually the last place we stayed in Portland had a washer and dryer, and I did a full load of laundry, so it was great. So anyhow, I'm very frugal when I travel. I also mentioned that I had found this airline, this Icelandic airline called WOW, which is offering flights from San Francisco to Europe for, Jesus, like 50 or 60% off typical rate. Now, I wasn't able to get any flights on that time because that's kind of like really popular time to fly to Europe during the holidays. And we're going to be in Europe from 26th to January 7th. So that's a couple of weeks. And so I couldn't fly on well. As it turns out, we got flights on Aer Lingus. And Aer Lingus is an Irish airline in Dublin. So that's the hub. So we'll fly from San Francisco to Dublin, a couple hour there, and then jump on a plane right into Paris. So, yeah, I mean, you can really fly, you know, any place now if you really look around for cheap. And I've mentioned many, many, many times that the real ancient cultures, for those of us who live in the LA, who live in the United States, the real ancient cultures around us are in Mexico. And you can fly to Mexico and Cancun and these other places just for a few hundred bucks. So, you know, get out and check it out. I mean, it's not that expensive. Check out these ruins that are right in your backyard. So fly. Interesting goings on this week. As always, check out the Facebook page. Have a ton of new material that I've posted. One of the things I want to mention is we always post galleries, and I posted two different galleries I want to highlight. One is called Rock Penetrating Technology, which was submitted by a amateur photographer who actually took a lot of photos of some of the pyramids, but also collected photographs. And this is, Jesus, looks like it's about 167 photographs on this gallery. And it's a collection of obviously machined areas of pyramids. There's even a few quarries where this individual has shown evidence of some kind of saw. And he's basically calling it cutting, scooping, and leveling technology. And it's really fascinating when you guys post these photographs. And a lot of people who are members of the Facebook page, the Earth Ancients Facebook page, can post photographs of their travels, and I really appreciate it. This is really a fun gallery. So check that one out. And then the other one is rock cutting technology in Spain. And we don't talk a lot about Spain, but Spain is very, very old. And these images are revealing some kind of cutting technology in old quarries in Spain. There's also shaping, and it looks like some kind of a machine cut into the side of these stones, and there's evidence of blades. There's evidence of deep cuts with some kind of machinery in different portions of rocks. So over 100 images in this gallery. And you can see it. It's called, what is he calling this thing? It's called Tools of God, an interesting gallery of stone masonry in Spain, and various types of tool marks left in ancient stone. It was submitted to us just about 5 days ago. So really interesting, real eye-opening. Unfortunately, we don't have evidence of the machines that cut these stones, but the evidence is in the remains of the machine cuts. So very, very, very interesting.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Okay, so here's a very, very interesting story that came out of a Japanese news release. The Japanese have found an ancient Roman coin They found it in the castle ruins in Okinawa. And fabulous to see something like this. They're dating it between the 12th and 15th century in the Roman Empire. How it got out there, I mean, we know the Romans were conquering most of Europe, but to find one of their coins in Japan is pretty mind-blowing. It's been x-rayed. It has the image of Constantine the First and a soldier holding a spear. And boy, I love it. I love it. If the Romans got out that far, that's pretty amazing. You can see the actual coin. You can see what they found on the Earth Ancients page. There's a lot of great detail. And this just shows you that our history has to be rewritten. There's a lot of activity from some of these early cultures, early historic cultures that we just don't talk about. And to have this information posted in a major Japanese newspaper is great that they're not covering that up. But it's very, very interesting to check out. So Earth Ancients group page, and you can see it on Facebook. So check it out. Okay, so this is our guest today. This is Nick Redfern, and I think you're going to enjoy this interview. So warfare appears to be a very human trait. We go to war throughout history. There's historical wars. One of the earlier wars we know about is the Trojan Wars, written about by the Greeks. And of course, all of us incarnated now who are on the earth know about the Second World War. There was a war fought in Europe. There was a war fought in the Pacific with Japan. And the current technology, the technology of the time, was bullets and especially, you know, gases, poisonous gases. And the ultimate weapon was the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which basically obliterated those cities and ended the war. The United States would eventually develop the nuclear bomb, and although it was detonated a number of times, it was never used in any war. Since that time, there are a number of countries that have the nuclear bomb, including North Korea, which is kind of an unstable part of the world. But to date, we don't have any evidence, or we don't know of any country, and thankfully, they haven't dropped or used a nuclear weapon because it's a devastating weapon. But is there evidence of an earlier civilization on Earth that have used devastating weapons, powerful weapons that could kill tens of thousands of people? And it's something to consider, because there is some strange parts of the world that appear to have been wiped out, or have evidence of devastation on a large scale. And today my guest is Nick Redfern, who is a wonderful artist. I was just mentioning him before the show. He's a prolific author. He's written over 30 books. And he has written a new book called Weapons of the Gods. And we're going to talk to Nick about this today, because it's not only something that's a fascination to many of us in terms of the evidence of an ancient culture using super weapons, but it makes us think of the human condition. Why would they use weapons of this nature, a nuclear bomb, and what is the evidence of that? Nick, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
Hi, Cliff. I'm doing good, thanks.
Great. Hey, this is a great book. It's very interesting. It's filled with examples and evidence of powerful weaponry, and you've explained it in as much detail as you can. What was the interest in writing a book on ancient weapons?
Well, it is a subject that's interested me for a long time. You know, these rumors that either visiting extraterrestrials or earlier human civilizations may have flourished on our planet and mm-hmm. only to destroy themselves and to sort of become the stuff of legend and folklore, you know, sort of a kind of equivalent of Atlantis, that type of thing. And the stories have interested me a lot. And when I'm writing a book, I always, or when I'm planning to write a book, I should say, you know, I always think carefully about coming up with a new idea, because you just don't want to kind of regurgitate old stuff and old scenarios and,
right.
you know, just rehash somebody else's book. It's just pointless. So I always think carefully about, you know, doing a book as to what the subject matter is going to be. And so I sort of spent a bit of time, like about a month or so, just going through pretty much, you know, the aspects of this particular story, and thought, well, you know, there is enough material here to, you know, to warrant a full-length book. But right. one of the things, as you know from the book, I think it's important to present both sides of the argument. And when you're dealing with something which is so controversial as the idea of ancient nuclear warfare, then it's not enough to just, you know, go in and say what people may want to hear, because that's, you know, that's not the business I'm in. I'm in the business
right.
of presenting what we know for sure. And some of the things that we know for sure aren't as strong as some people might assume them to be. And other issues, I think, are strong and intriguing. So in other words, it's not a skeptical take, but it's not a wide-eyed, gullible acceptance either of the data. It's presenting both sides. And if people like the fact that I promote this aspect, that's fine. And if they don't like the fact that I knock down one of the sort of you know, the stable aspects of this story, well, that's too bad. You know, that's how it goes.
Let's bring that up in the beginning, because we talked a little bit offline
yeah.
about that, and that is this ancient alien phenomenon, where if there is some anomalous remains on the surface, like glass or
yeah.
Craters or whatever, that it's immediately designated as an ancient alien phenomenon. And you basically
yeah.
outlined this in the very beginning, that it's important to consider other aspects than immediately falling on the ancient alien hypothesis. Why do you feel that?
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, when we have these stories, you know, anybody who's interested in the ancient astronauts issue will have heard these tales about, you know, the Mahabharata and ancient nuclear warfare, Vimana, Sodom and Gomorrah, all coming into play into this particular story. But I think it's important that we sort of retain a level head. And, for example, you're right, when you talk about anomalous craters and flattened areas of ground thousands of years ago, there is very often a tendency on the part of certain people to suggest that, well, this is definitely evidence of, you know, a nuclear attack or a nuclear exchange or something like that. When in reality, some of these events could have been sort of meteorite strikes, asteroids, etc., comets even. And I think that's why it's important that we kind of go where we can, at least, bear in mind how old some of these stories are, you know, with the facts, rather than just jump to the conclusion that it's got to be aliens, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
which it actually doesn't have to be, but it could be. But it's important, again, that, you know, we demonstrate both sides of the argument when it comes to these specific events.
I agree 100%. It's just that this TV show is so popular, and it's so easy to fall into it, because if you can't explain an anomalous feature or an artifact, it's automatically like, well, it couldn't have happened 5,000 years ago that way. We were hunters and gatherers. We weren't sophisticated humans. And I tend to think that it also falls on the Western point of view, our myopic view of there's no one else in the world but Western mm-hmm. culture, and they don't look into
yeah.
ancient Chinese or Hindu culture that goes thousands and thousands of years beyond our current understanding. In fact, later in this program, we'll talk about parts of India that are extremely old. So I think that it's just we're myopic. We just don't get it. And ancient aliens.
No, that does happen. There's no doubt about that. You know, that there's this perception that, I mean, I've had this conversation before. You know, people have asked me, because I'm originally from England, people over here ask me, oh, you know, do you all have cell phones and, you know, iPads and everything? I'm like, well, yeah. And I said, you know, you get everybody's got them, France, Germany, Russia, and that. Like, somebody actually said, no, Russia, there are no like iPads in Russia or anything like that. Of course there is. And people just don't get the fact that the advanced parts, the more advanced parts of the world are on a par with each other, really, you know, technology-wise. It's not like it's just, you know, a couple of countries that have iPhones and, you know, Netflix or whatever.
Yes. Yes, so fascinating. Well, let's get into this wonderful
book. We are
guilty
of that, there's no doubt.
Well, I mean, those of us in the United States are very privileged, and I think we're so comfortable with our lives, we don't really have a lot of us don't have a global view of things, and that's really not good. And what Earth Ancients tries to do is help people see beyond their the outside of their fence.
Well, I think a lot of countries are like that. I mean, certainly, you know, the UK, where I'm originally from. I mean, you know, everybody in the family has a car. There's three TVs. You know, that's the same like France, Germany, Holland, Italy. Everywhere's like that, you know, and I think we do kind of just get set in your ways, you know, based around your life. You know, I guess that's sort of natural, really, in some respects, but also it does create sort of like a blurred vision of other countries as well, you know, and they can't have what we have, but they actually do. So.
Let's talk about this book, Weapons of the Gods, and the work that you've done. You encapsulate a lot. Let's start with the most famous destruction and what your research was on Sodom and Gomorrah. What did you discover about this event that's kind of unique?
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said in the early part of the book, in the introduction, I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't think there was some validity to this particular theory of ancient nuclear war. And some of the cases are more persuasive than others. Now, when it comes to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, that's probably one of the most famous cases that everybody, whether they adhere to the theory or not, or whether they read the Bible or not, everybody knows the story that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by God, and it's a story told in the Old Testament's book of Genesis. Yeah. And it actually appears also, but not to as much of a significant degree, in the Quran and also in the Hadith, which is the collected quotes of Muhammad, the prophet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it does have a long history. Now, the official or the accepted story is that basically God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, you know, just wasn't happy with the lifestyle that the people had.
Right.
And there are actually five cities in that particular area. A lot of people forget that. There were Sodom, Gomorrah, Zoar, Zeboim, and Admar. And of the five, only Zoar was spared obliteration. All four were actually destroyed, but everybody just focuses on, you know, for the most part, Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, the story's interesting because if this was sort of a random, out-of-the-blue event like an asteroid strike, you know, there would be no warning because it would be hurtling through the solar system and then come through the atmosphere and slam into the ground with such force, you would have no advance warning, particularly back then. But what's intriguing is that the story itself, which much of it revolves around this character Lot and his family, there's this story of this visitation by these mysterious visitors who essentially told Lot to, you know, get the hell out of Dodge, so to speak, you know, and take your family with them. So in other words, it sounds like, you know, however you interpret it, it sounds as if somebody from here or somewhere else had advance warning that the cities were going to be targeted and were going to be destroyed. Now, I guess the one part of the story that everybody remembers is that when Lot and his daughters and his wife fled the cities, what happened was that his wife either looked back or turned back, which is more likely, and traveled back, where she was supposedly turned into this pillar of salt. Now, of course, there's no way that an atomic explosion can turn anybody into a pillar of salt. It's impossible. But what's intriguing is if you look back at the original ancient texts, the term for salt way back then was actually interchangeable with the word vapor. So, in other words, you could actually make an argument that Lot's wife was vaporized because if she didn't just look back but turned back and headed back to the cities, well, you know, and if Lot and his daughters were 20 miles away and she was 3 miles away, you know, the sheer power of atomic bombs today, you know, if you're 3 miles from an atomic bomb, chances are you're not going to survive it with today's weapons. You know, you will be vaporized. That's the sheer power of today's atomic weapons. So, you know, that's kind of interesting, the idea that she was vaporized. And, of course, the story also talks about in the immediate aftermath of the detonations, that, you know, there were sort of these plumes of smoke, and it talks about how sulfur rained down on Sodom and Gomorrah, and everything was destroyed in the cities. That's how the book of Genesis describes it. And it also talks about this dense smoke rising from the land, like smoke from a furnace. That's the exact description. And it kind of sounds a little bit like the classic mushroom cloud, you know, this huge plume of smoke and fire just hanging in the air. So, you know, for me, the Sodom and Gomorrah story is a really interesting one, and I actually do find that sort of fairly persuasive. And again, but I point out that it's important when you're interpreting ancient texts, which themselves have been translated and rewritten and passed down orally for a number of generations, then you have to be aware of that fact as well, I think, you know, to be balanced.
What would you say when you describe and interpret these stories? I mean, the technology and the science behind the development of these kind of powerful weapons has to be fairly sophisticated. And so we're talking about a science from, you know, an unknown science. And whenever we think about these ancient stories and these ancient texts, there's something missing in the equation that's never really discussed. And I'm just curious about what your thinking is of where would this technology come from? I mean, because the research and development for the atomic bomb was, you know, it was very, very intense, a lot of man hours, millions of dollars, and then we have this bomb. But, I mean, in this old period, what do you think the science is all about?
No, well, that's a good question, because you're right that, you know, you can't just sort of go down your local store and get the ingredients, you know, to make an atomic bomb. it's far from that simple at all. So if, you know, the stories are true, then there's one of two ways of looking at it, that there were ancient cultures that developed this technology, or there are extraterrestrials that visited the Earth and had a presence on the Earth and developed and used the technology as well. But of course, the big question is, where's the evidence? You know, beyond the stories and beyond some of these curious craters and things like that, where's the evidence? Now, this sort of gets to the point of your question. If, for example, there were ancient civilizations that did develop atomic weapons, I don't think we're talking about anything along the lines of like a huge worldwide civilization like we have today. You know, it's like if we, God forbid it happened, but if we had a third world war and all the, you know, the superpowers got dragged into it, you know, the US, China, Russia, and everybody pushed the button, you know, it would be like 95% wipeout everywhere. The, you know, the surviving numbers would be so low. But even probably 20,000 years later, there would still be remains, you know, of rusted old cars and buildings all across the planet. But, you know, there would just be destroyed, but you would still find evidence of them. Now, this leads me to believe, because we haven't found evidence of some previous massive worldwide civilization, I think the most likely scenario, if these accounts are real, is that we're dealing with localized advanced civilizations. In other words, where you may have had parts of the world that were still using bows and arrows, you know, and things like that, and other parts that may have been really advanced. In the same way, you know, that like we talked about iPads and iPhones earlier, and there are still tribes like in South America that still hunt with bows and arrows, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be something like that. So I think that
That's
might be more likely if they developed something localized. They were relatively small bodies of people, but highly advanced. And if they did engage in war and their civilizations are actually quite small, then that could have resulted in complete obliteration of not just their cultures, but the technology that they developed. In other words, if it had been a worldwide technology back then, we would have seen it, some evidence of it. The fact that we aren't makes me think, you know, it could have been localized to, you know, one small country that just got wiped out, you know.
That's a really good point. I kind of feel that there's a whole part of our history that's missing. And people like Graham Hancock talk about an asteroid hit that basically leveled the Earth and wiped off the planet, these sophisticated civilizations that may have developed atomic warfare or even nuclear warfare. And so it's hard to say. And you're right, finding evidence for this is really sketchy. The only places we have evidence are in places where the ruins are still there, and we have sophisticated cutting of stonework and drilling and things like that, which would let us think that there's machines that were at that time. But I guess that leads me to the next question. And you talk a great deal about Vimanas. And Vimanas are these flying craft that are all through the various Hindu texts. And the reason I want to talk about Vimanas is that would be a real good delivery system for a bomb. And if they existed, which I don't think anyone's ever found one, but I'm really curious to know what you think about Vimanas and if they actually were around.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the Vimanas, for people who aren't aware, were some sort of mysterious flying vehicle that the people of ancient India had thousands of years ago. You know, how many years exactly is very much open to question and open to debate. So, you know, in that sense, it's a controversial issue. The idea that somebody achieved sort of manned flight thousands of years before the Wright brothers allegedly did, you know, which would very much turn history on its head. Now, if you look at some of the old artistic renditions and place them against, you know, today's stories, if you watch a TV show that mentions Vimanas, invariably they're presented with sort of cool CGI images of these sleek metallic craft, you know, flying, soaring across the skies at high speed. Some of the older paintings and renditions almost sort of resemble sort of bizarre novel 19th century sci-fi interpretations of what, you know, flight might be like, you know, with bizarre looking balloon type craft, that kind of thing. So you know, there's no doubt that there's a great deal of interpretation, but what is interesting is, you know, the ancient texts do talk about these Vimanas, these fantastic vehicles or crafts that could take to the sky. You know, for example, Walter Raymond Drake, who was an early sort of researcher and writer about ancient astronaut stuff, he said that they actually stated that the Indian battles, if you like, were aerial battles between gods and demons waged with nuclear bombs. That's his exact words. And he cited, for example, the classic epic, the Ramayana, and he felt that it actually did describe an ancient nuclear war. And certainly, you know, that's a big scenario today, but Drake was probably one of the first people to bring up this connection between the Vimanas, the Ramayana and nuclear war, and the Vimanas essentially taking to the skies and unleashing air-to-surface nuclear weapons. And But, I mean, one of the important things that I stress in the book, and a lot of researchers of this field don't like to talk about this because I think they feel it weakens their argument, but I feel it weakens your argument if you don't bring it up. And that's the fact that there was this ancient book that was published back in the 20th century called the Vimanika Shastra. And it was actually a book written by a guy named Pandit Subbaraya Sastry.
Right.
It was translated into English by a guy named G.R. Joyser. Now, what happened was that Sastry wrote this book, if you like, which was filled with artistic renditions and a great deal of data on the history of the Vimanas and how they flew, and they were these wonderful, you know, incredible craft. But as I said, there's one thing that a lot of researchers of this very often don't like talking about, and that is namely that Sastry reportedly got all of the information about the Vimanas, not through, you know, archaeological digs or historical studies of the area, but via channeling. Now, you know, I'm not knocking channeling as a potential real phenomenon, but I just wish, you know, that some researchers at least would make it more clear that a lot of the stories we have about the Vimanas don't come from historical record. They come from directly from Sastry and this highly influential book. And in terms of the Vimana, it is a highly influential book. You know.
Yes. But I think you even, I've read this, and I think you mentioned it in the book, that Indian scientists just can't validate it because it doesn't have any scientific evidence or references to known locations or anything like that. So they have a problem.
No, you're right. It doesn't. Yeah, and you know, and as I said, I'm not here to deny the potential reality of channeling, but I think it's important we stress that to people that a lot of this did come from channeling. I mean, a lot of the stuff that is spoken about or talked about in that particular book, you know, the kind of things that people like Jules Verne were talking about, you know, and some of the early sci-fi fantasy authors. That doesn't mean, you know, Sastry took it from there, but it does mean that, you know, the evidence for Vimanas, I won't say it's flimsy, it's just the fact that it's been collected in such an alternative, controversial way. So.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, would you say any of it is valid at all? I mean, when you think
of... Oh, well, I actually do. You see, again, this comes back to why, I think it's an important subject to talk about, because, you know, you can find, you know, you can take Sastry out of the equation, and you can still find these ancient texts that talk about Vimanas, you know, that could take to the skies and perform, you know, incredible speeds, etc. And when you find these stories throughout a great deal of ancient Indian lore and legend, then, you know, you have to sort of keep it open that, well, you know, they're talking about these Vimanas so much, maybe there actually was something to them. You know, but again, I think the problem is that it's been sort of mixed in with a few sensational stories, people who've interpreted it this way and that way and so forth. And so, you know, what becomes a genuine interest in mystery, it almost becomes an article of faith that Vimanas were Top Gun style nuclear armed aircraft. And for me, it's a big leap to say that unless you're going to qualify by saying, well, look, you know, let's just take it easy. Let's take your foot off the accelerator a little bit. You know what I mean?
Exactly. You know, but what's really interesting is I've seen what are supposedly mechanical drawings and blueprints of Vimanas. And the most frequently used one is this, looks like a multi-tiered cake. And it's like, it's so aerodynamically flawed. It's like, how in the hell is this thing going to get going anywhere? It's like, it doesn't make any sense to me when I see that thing.
No, it's not like, I mean, I've actually seen some TV shows, you know, where they've used CGI and they do look more like sleek Top Gun type aircraft. But you're right, if you look at those old pictures, they really do look like multi-tiered cakes. And, you know, I guess the closest thing I can think of, it kind of makes me think somebody was, it was like a poor rendition of like a, a balloon of some sort, you know.
It's just strange.
But on the other hand, you're right. There's nothing aerodynamic in the old pictures, you know, and that would be kind of strange, because if you're planning on zipping around the skies and, you know, unleashing nuclear weapons and so forth, you want some sort of vehicle that is going to be able to actually fly through the skies and cut through the atmosphere and the air very easily, you know, not something that's, you know, it's kind of like flying a barrel through the sky, you know, it's not going to work that well.
Did you in your research find any evidence of a delivery system for weaponries of any kind that seemed very sophisticated other than the Vimana?
Well, I guess the closest I can think of, you know, is, again, if you go back to the ancient Indian texts where they talk about these sort of like rods of iron being unleashed, you know, and provoking massive destruction and so forth. And inevitably, and interestingly enough, you know, people have suggested, well, these sort of rods or these pillars of iron, you know, were somebody's ancient way of trying to explain a missile or something along those lines. That's about the closest thing I can think of. You know, people aren't saying that the Vimanas themselves were not just the delivery system, but the weapon as well. That, you know, they weren't clearly the weapon. But then, you know, you have these stories about, as I said, these iron rods being unleashed and so on. And maybe they were, you know, maybe they were, like, that was the delivery system itself. You know, that was the missile. But again, you know, it's how you interpret it. You know, that's
exactly
what we're still up against, really. I mean, some of these old stories of pictures, like you just mentioned about the Vimanas as well, you know, they've had these tiny propellers on them, which are so small that, you know, they just wouldn't get anything off the ground at all.
I'm wondering if these blueprints I have seen are from this channeled interpretation of this of what the Vimanas were, because when you look at them, it's like, this is, I mean, unless there's a force field around this thing to get it off the air, those little propellers aren't going to do it. And of course, you mentioned this in your book, that it's crazy, some of the propellants that were described using mercury and things like that. And people are kind of like scratching their head going, this is all, you know, it's a mishmash of ingredients.
But again, I think, you know, the one important thing is, you know, if you sort of view Sastry's story of, you know, being essentially downloaded this material into his mind, that doesn't take away the fact that there is a rich history of ancient flying craft in India. You know, regardless what you think of it or anybody thinks of it or the stories, the culture does talk about that, or did talk about that back then. You know, so that, that does at least, you know, intrigue and should intrigue people, the idea that there is this, you know, pre-existing belief system that there was manned flight thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because I've studied a little bit about Indian culture, and some of these buildings, at the top of them, they're called Vimana, and they're shaped like these craft. And I'm just wondering if maybe the interpretation has got skewed a little bit, and they're thinking they're confusing the two. And I think that has happened, hasn't it? Where there is some confusion about what these craft are, actually were, and their comparison to the buildings.
Oh yeah. I mean, some of the Vimanas themselves, they look sort of like royal palaces, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
they actually don't look like craft. So, you know, there's a great deal of sort of murky areas in this subject. It's not as black and white that it's myth or they were, you know, the equivalents of the Air Force's most advanced aircraft today. No, there's, you know, that you've got to look at the whole thing and the downloading of the channel material and the bizarre pictures and artistic renditions and, you know, the fact that they do look like ornate palaces in some respect as well. So
they are quite interesting. Hey, let's talk about ground zero for a couple of these so-called blasts. You describe the ancient Indus River Valley area of India and the city known as Mohenjo-Daro and what happened there. Can you talk a little bit about what what you describe in the book on that area?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the story of Mohenjo-Daro has become sort of like one of the staple ones, you know, within ancient astronaut research today. If people discuss ancient nuclear war, you know, there are several issues that always crop up: Sodom and Gomorrah, the Indian Mahabharata, and Mohenjo-Daro. Now, Mohenjo-Daro, excuse me, it exists in the sort of Larkana district of Pakistan, Pakistan's Sindh province, as it's known. And although the existence, you know, of the area, the old city, the ruined city, was known obviously to the people of that era and that area at the time, it actually wasn't until the early years of the 20th century that excavations actually began in and around Mohenjo-Daro, and more took place in the 50s and 60s. Now, the city, you know, it wasn't a gigantic city. It was about 250 acres, but the people that built it were actually very skilled. You know, they had buildings, they had sewers, etc., etc., and there have been stories, which probably are true, that they even had underground heating as well, you know, to keep the buildings warm and things like that. So, and we also know that they used stone and bronze, you know, to create bronze statues. So they were, you know, they were highly evolved people. Now, there are a number of stories that suggest that one of the big anomalies surrounding Mohenjo-Daro is that at some point, round about close to 2000 BC, that the people of that area fled the city. Now, if you read some books and some articles online, you'll see references to essentially Mohenjo-Daro and also another city as well called Harappa having been sort of essentially nuked and destroyed. But if you look at the cities themselves, you know, the ruins are still there, but they're not the kind of ruins that you would expect to see in a nuclear attack. Now, the late Philip Coppens was someone who focused quite heavily on Mohenjo-Daro, and he came to the conclusion that rather than being sort of the subject of direct strikes, that Mohenjo-Daro specifically, the people fled the radiation clouds coming towards the city. And that, in other words, you know, if we had a nuclear war today, let's say one big city gets hit, well, you know, you might think you're safe if you're 10 miles away until you see the blast winds blowing towards you. And then 5 days later, you know, you start to bleed out your gums and everywhere, you know, and you've got radiation poisoning. So that is one of the theories with Mohenjo-Daro, that it wasn't sort of directly nuked, but it was essentially, you know, the radiation. Now, in saying that, there's the most controversial story is this theory that, or widespread tale, that highly radioactive skeletons have been found in the area. And, you know, the deeper they go down, the more radioactive these skeletons are. Now, the big question is, you know, to what extent does this have validity attached to it? And one of the things Philip Coppens pointed out was that in those very areas today, in the last couple of decades, have been issues with atomic plants, etc., you know, releasing radiation. And some researchers have suggested, well, that may have contaminated, you know, the archaeological sites. And we're not sure to what extent these stories are true. They've very much been sort of circulated and passed around. But, you know, I've not seen anything conclusive, really, that suggests dozens and dozens of highly radioactive skeletons, specifically dating from this period, can be shown to have been irradiated back then. You know, that's what we need to make that full case, and we haven't done that yet. So.
Is there any evidence of this, I'm just going to call it desert glass or nuclear glass in that area?
Oh, well, actually, there is. Well, not in relation to Mohenjo-Daro, no, but there are a lot of examples across the Middle East, like Libya, Egypt, and elsewhere, and where this strange glassy substance has been found strewn all across the landscape. One of the more interesting stories is the fact that the famous Egyptian pharaoh, Tutankhamun, actually wore a piece of this glass in a necklace. And for people who aren't aware of it, this sort of goes back to the Second World War final stages when, you know, we finally developed the atomic bomb. And as you said in the introduction, you know, they were used on Japan to finally end the war. Now, before the two bombs were dropped on Japan, a test bomb was dropped, well, that was exploded, I should say, was detonated out at the White Sands Proving Ground, as it was known back then, in New Mexico. And the site that was picked was known as the Trinity Site. And even then, scientists like Dr. Robert Oppenheimer, who, you know, one of the main forces in the atomic bomb development, even he wasn't sure what would happen. But when they detonated the bomb, you know, there was a massive explosion, you know, the mushroom cloud, everything. But right. One of the unforeseen side effects was the incredible temperatures that the detonation provoked. It whipped up literally thousands and thousands of tons of sand grains into the air, and the sheer heat effectively melted the sand and turned it into this glassy substance, which became known as Trinitite after the fact it was the Trinity site.
Right.
And you can actually buy Trinitite online now. There's quite a few places that sell it. Yes, yeah. Now, the government frowned on it for quite a while, but they kind of just, you know, turn away now and just don't bother. But what's interesting is that you can find near identical glass, if you like, all across various portions of the Middle East. As I said, Libya, Egypt, you know, being two specific places. And there are only really several ways that you could have this ancient glassy substance all across the Middle East, which resembles what happened in New Mexico. And that is, well, the main thing is you need something with incredible heat. And so if something slammed into the ground or detonated, it would have to be either something like an atomic bomb or a meteorite or an asteroid coming through the Earth's atmosphere and heating up so much that when it slammed into the ground, you know, it would just create this scenario. Now, the big problem with the idea of it being an asteroid or a meteorite is that both an asteroid or a meteorite would cause significant craters to be created. But in a lot of the areas where we find the green glass, we don't find craters. Now, contrary to a lot of people think, you don't always get a crater with an atomic bomb. One of the reasons being, if it's an airburst, in other words, you know, some bombs are dropped so they detonate as they hit the ground, or they're detonated on the ground. There are actually benefits from the military's perspective having an airburst, because you actually have this situation where, you know, the explosion, if you like, creates sort of maximum damage, becomes radioactive, I should say. So in other words, something like an airburst of an atomic bomb would provoke the the development of some sudden spontaneous transition to like trinitite, but it wouldn't necessarily create a huge crater. So in that sense, you know, there is an very intriguing argument to be made there that somebody, you know, had let loose something very much similar to our atomic bombs today.
I didn't know that a meteorite hitting the ground would create, I guess, heat like that, but I guess it does because it's flying in at such great rates of speed.
Well, yeah, well, that's the problem. That's like when the astronauts come back from, you know, when we used to have the space shuttle and the moon missions and everything else, you know, they'd have to have these basically heat protection because the temperature would increase to incredible, you know, degrees of heat. As it's like friction. You know, it's kind of like running your finger up and down like a rope. You know, you're climbing a rope and you slip down the rope. Within seconds, you know, your hand's on fire. It's kind of like that. It's just friction heats up. But yeah, if you've got something like, you know, a meteorite coming through the Earth's atmosphere, let's say the size of a school bus, you know, and that's weighing multiple tons, as that comes through the atmosphere, it literally is almost on fire. It's that hot, you know, it's melting.
Amazing.
And so when it hits the ground, the specific area, it's a desert area, it immediately affects that sandy area and just blasts it into the sky, you know, just like a normal explosion would, and it rains down as this sort of greenish glass. So it's basically due to the heat. It's not caused by something slowing into the ground. It's caused by something provoking incredible heat in a sandy environment.
That's fascinating. You know, you brought up meteors and craters, and I do want to, before we leave India, I want to talk about the Lanar crater and the possible evidence of it being the result of a weapon. And I didn't even think about that. And the reason I want to talk about it is you also discuss the fact that in our modern times, we haven't been hit by asteroids or meteors of such a great size. Yeah. And maybe this is something to consider in this crater. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good point, you know, and I think it was an important one, which is why I brought it up. You know, people say, well, these were just meteorites and asteroids and comets hitting the planet 5 or 10,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask. Well, if they were hitting the planet 20,000 years ago and 10,000 years ago and 5 and 2, why aren't we getting them now? You know, that's one of the... That's a legitimately interesting and kind of intriguing and weird issue that you would imagine it would still be going on if it's just random things in the universe, you know, coming through the solar system and slamming into us. But it's not happening. So, again, that's why, you know, you could argue that's because they actually weren't meteorites or asteroids, you know. Mm-hmm. But, the Lanar crater that you talk about in India, it's actually quite a big crater. It's like 500 feet deep, and its rim itself is in excess of 60 feet, and its circumference is actually around about 6,000 feet. And NASA itself has actually taken quite a lot of interest in this and has had satellites projected over it, you know, getting photographs and things like this. And but what's interesting is that in terms of the crater itself, it actually has an intriguing story attached to it, namely that it was inhabited by this sort of demonic type entity known as Lonasura. That's where the name Lonar comes from his name, so to speak. And he was perceived as like this powerful supernatural being who sort of terrorized, threatened, and controlled the people of that particular area. And it comes down to where, for example, Vishnu, the god, created this avatar and who came down, and there was this sort of violent battle between the two, and the demon Lanasura lost the battle. Now, today, the crater itself is sort of peppered by various ruined temples and things like that, and it's sort of given rise to the idea that, you know, the stories of this battle between the gods, you know, the good gods and this demonic entity could have been a distortion passed down orally across the centuries of some sort of war in India, you know, between rival forces. One of them unleashed an atomic weapon and created this huge crater that became the Lanar crater. Now, whether or not that's true, you know, we don't know, but it is intriguing that there is this mythology and this folklore that surrounds the crater and that talks about it having been sort of essentially, you know, the home of this sort of supernatural being that the gods fought, you know. So.
Very, very, very interesting description. I want to also come to the United States, and you describe the native Klamath people of Oregon and their description of the formation of Crater Lake, or the crater in Oregon, known as the Crater Lake area. Can you talk a little bit about that? And maybe, I mean, it's formed by what we thought was a meteor, but maybe there's something more to it.
Well, yeah, this is one where, you know, I demonstrate the need for caution as well. Crater Lake, what is known today is Crater Lake National Park, and it's in south central Oregon. Now, the official story is that around about 7,500 years ago, there was a massive volcanic eruption on what's called Mount Mazama, and that led to the creation of Crater Lake, which is actually around about 2,000 feet deep. And a lot of people don't realize this, but it's actually the deepest lake in the United States. And it's actually one of the top 10 deepest lakes in the entire planet. And the people you're talking about, the Klamath Native American people, they lived in all of the surrounding areas like Klamath Lake and Klamath River. And they have stories about, for example, these warring entities, you know, the gods of the underworld and the gods of above, doing battle and slinging these sort of fiery boulders at each other, which, you know, you could interpret as, you know, aliens or advanced species firing missiles, atomic missiles at each other and creating the crater. However, the evidence is pretty strong and persuasive that it really was down to some sort of volcanic eruption rather than anything anomalous. But the people of those areas, the Klamath people, did have legends of that it was down to the work of the gods. Now, if it wasn't down to the gods or the aliens, but they actually thought that was the case and created a story around it, then that obviously makes us, we should be cautious as to how many of these other stories, like with the Lonar crater, could that have been natural, but, a legend was created around it by the people of that era to explain away this massive hole. So the Klamath story is a very interesting one. You know, the Crater Lake story is an interesting one because on the one hand, you have the people of that area and that period saying, yes, you know, it was sort of this mighty battle between these opposing supernatural sides. But whereas today, it actually is pretty persuasive that it was, like I said, of a volcanic event. So I use that chapter particularly in the book to demonstrate how careful we need to be in interpreting these old stories and old texts and not, you know, sort of run away with them and because it sounds cool and exciting, you know.
Well, I liked it because it was on the West Coast, so I'm always interested in ancient culture on the West Coast, which brings me to an interesting subject that you pose continually in the book, which is what you call vitrified ruins. And vitrification usually is the result of extremely high heat on stone or walls made of very hard rock. And you give some evidence and some story that was researched by Captain Ives William Walker in Death Valley, California. Now, I did know that there's remains of ancient Native people there, but I didn't know that they had found vitrified ruins. Can you talk a little bit about what would be the cause for that?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, this is an interesting story from this guy, Captain Ives William Walker, who was sort of an American, like a real-life Indiana Jones type, is probably the best way to describe him. Now, he claimed that in the 19th century, midway through the 19th century, he came across something very strange in Death Valley, sort of nothing less than the vitrified remains of what were clearly sort of ruined structures. Now, it's a very interesting story because tales of vitrified buildings and structures do abound. I mean, I've got a chapter in the book about vitrified forts in Scotland, which is like a really weird mystery. So, you know, there are a lot of these stories. But one of the problems is, of course, today, that as interesting as Walker's story is, today at least, we haven't found, you know, those remains and ruins, which, you know, clearly we should have done, unless, as some people have suggested, that there was, you know, sort of earthquakes or, you know, the ground fell into itself. There are a few stories coming out of Death Valley of people sort of plunging into underground realms and that kind of thing. And some people have suggested that Walker may have sort of obfuscated things a bit because he wanted to be the guy who essentially sort of took the credit for it, and that what he may have found could actually have been vitrified remains deep underground that he'd found a way into some sort of ancient, you know, underground civilization that were destroyed, but, you know, that their buildings underground were vitrified rather than, you know, actually being on the surface. Some people do think he actually sort of, like I said, obfuscated and kind of twisted it to ensure that no one else would find it, but he was still essentially telling the true story. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, the Death Valley area has a lot of very, very interesting remains, including petroglyphs that are huge.
Yeah.
And it can
well, I'm sure you know there was like a cluster of stories you might remember, or not remember, but I mean, you'll know of, where you have these stories of adventurers, you know, falling into holes in Death Valley and coming across, you know, what looks like statues underground from like the equivalent of ancient Greece or Rome, and remains of saber-toothed tigers and camels. There was a sort of a cluster of stories like that that surfaced in sort of the 20s and the 30s. You know, which are interesting, but although some people sort of write off, you know, these vitrified ruins in Death Valley, you know, the fact is that we do have them in Scotland, and they're known as vitrified forts, where you have these ancient Scottish forts, and in certain places the stones are just literally melted together, you know, to make one big melted rock, essentially. Now, some researchers have suggested this was done deliberately by the people who created them. However, it's been shown scientifically that it's actually more robust to have them separate rather than vitrified and, you know, melted into one. Because, you know, if someone's able to tip part of it over, the whole thing goes, you know.
Right.
And a lot of studies have been done on these, and some researchers have suggested that sort of attacking forces, you know, would bring sort of flaming torches and things like that and would set fire to the exterior parts of the forts they were invading. But the temperatures that could be achieved by something like even, you know, 100 or 200 torches would still take actually a few hours to heat up to the point where they would literally melt. And of course,
right,
in that time, the defending forces would clearly have the ability to fight and try and prevent them from doing that. They're not just going to stand there and let the walls burn. And so it almost looks like when you see some of these forts that certain portions of them have been targeted by some sort of like incredibly high heat weapon. That's, you know, the best way to sort of describe it, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating. I want to remind our audience that Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia. And Gaia is this month presenting a whole new series called Ancient Space Science. And it's a 5-part series that they're offering right now for people who are Earth Ancient members. And to get onto this program, they're offering a special program of 99 cents for the first month and then $9.95 after. This special program, Ancient Space Science, features a number of experts. It's nothing close to ancient aliens. It's much, much more thorough, much greater evidence of off-world travel, potential locations around the globe of evidence of some high technology. And to see these programs, all you have to do is go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients, and you can sign up immediately for it. And when you sign up, you support Earth Ancients. And for 99 cents a month, you can't beat that to see these great ancient space science series. Now, that's just one of many, many hundreds of programs that you can see with people we've had on our show, like Graham Hancock, Nisam Harriman, and many, many others. So to get that program, go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients. Nick, in the time we have left, I want to talk a little bit about what your belief is on these ancient European tunnels. They're found in Turkey. They're found in parts of Europe. It's almost like they're a bomb shelter in areas. And I'm just wondering, did you find any evidence for any kind of detonation point with any of these tunnels, or did they come into play in any of your research?
Well, I am aware of those. I mean, because I've actually seen some of them personally, being from Europe. But I actually didn't mention this in the book because, you know, I felt that it was more on the lines of I would be kind of just interpreting them as bomb shelters because that might be the way we would, you know, use them today, rather than having some other reason. However, what I would say is that I think it could be an important component from the perspective that, you know, if something's showering down from the skies, whether natural or man-made or extraterrestrial-made, the best thing to do is get deep underground as you can. You know, that's why, you know, right. So many governments have underground bunkers built, you know, to withstand nuclear attacks, that kind of thing. So, you know, you could make that argument that somebody knew far more than we do and had literally prepared, you know, to basically go down there for however many weeks, months were needed and then come back up and try and start over again, you know. But we find a lot of weird things like that, sort of caverns, tunnels, you know, evidence of multiple people living in deep caves and things like this. And you do have to wonder if this was specifically due to the fact that, you know, the planet had been contaminated or, you know, there was something with the atmosphere, that kind of thing. So,
I mean, we're talking in some places in Turkey of underground caverns that could hold thousands and thousands of people. And have evidence of livestock and special air vents that brought air into the, you know, hundreds of feet underground. So it's weird
that's actually a good point with that, with the Turkish ones, because if you're taking, you know, like cattle underground, then clearly that would kind of suggest that they were being kept there because it wasn't safe above ground, you know. You don't just sort of take cattle into some deep cavern for the sake of it, you know. Mm-hmm. But you may well do that if you're worried that, you know, radioactive contamination's coming and you have some understanding of it. Or, you know, you're seeing massive explosions on the horizon and you plan for it, you know, and you get everybody and, your livestock and everything underground. So.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider. I have to ask you this because this is one of your the features of your research. Can you give a couple of examples of what you find is probably the best evidence for off-world beings using weapons on Earthlings, or perhaps supporting an Earth-based civilization with weaponry?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think certainly from my perspective, you know, I still think Sodom and Gomorrah is a fairly persuasive one. You know, I think that is a very interesting one. And I also am intrigued by the Indian stories of Mahabharata, but, you know, a lot of it is so contaminated with sensational stuff that it's sort of lost its, you know, its uniqueness, so to speak. But what I do think is interesting, there are these stories also that come from the Great Lakes region of the United States. And we know for sure that in the past, in thousands of years ago, there was sort of massive irradiation of the area somewhere between 18,000 and 8,000 BC. We cannot really figure it more precise than that. But what it demonstrates is extremely high levels of what's called radiocarbon in and around the Great Lakes areas, suggesting some sort of massive atomic event of some sort. So, you know, I think the Great Lakes area stories, they're pretty interesting as well.
Is there any place or any reference you can give where there's evidence of a technology be it residue on the ground or these tintrite glass pieces or maybe something similar where people just scratch their head because it's so radically unusual that would maybe lead one to think, well, this is off-world. This must be off-world technology.
Well, I mean, I would definitely say with the stuff that this green glass, like the trinitite, I would say, definitely sort of look up the stories about, for example, what's called Libyan glass. Just type in Libyan glass. You'll find a lot of material, a lot of stories about that, which is a legitimate mysterious phenomenon. You find it also in Egypt, as I said, with Tutankhamun, in Israel as well. So, we have that evidence. And I do find some of the other evidence, which some researchers dismiss, these sort of little models and carvings that look like ancient aircraft. Now, I know there are arguments on both sides, when it comes to these things, but I kind of find that interesting, that somebody would actually carve these little trinkets and toys and things like that that look quite like aircraft, So
that is interesting.
But the problem is, of course, we don't have what, like I mentioned before, we don't have what we would have today, which would, even after thousands of years, with our worldwide culture, there would be massive amounts of remains, but just destroyed remains. And I think it comes down to, again, that if there were these cultures, they were so localized and small, but ironically advanced in the process, that when they went, there was just nothing left because their civilization was so small to start with. We kind of think if you've got atomic weapons, you've got this worldwide civilization, but it may not be. It could have been the world in the distant past could have been much different to ours. They may not have had TVs, the internet, but they might have understood how to crack the atom,
That's a fascinating thought. and it's one to really consider simply because a thousand years is a long time, and a lot of evidence for a culture that may have written on paper or anything that isn't hardened as rock would basically disappear. It would evaporate into space. So what would be the evidence? The only evidence would be is if they were megalithic builders of rock and things like that. So.
On that latter point, you can sort of, talk about the stone of the pregnant woman at Baalbek, this gigantic slab of stone, and there's two which actually now, slightly bigger and heavier. So maybe that's some sort of example. I mean, those kind of stones, I mean, that's incredible workmanship, you know what I mean?
Amazing.
There's no way really to move those things.
Yeah, that is a fascinating example of a lost culture. Of course, in Egypt, there's other examples of these massive sculptures that just are mind-blowing as to how they were moved. So anyhow, it's been a pleasure. The book, my guest today is Weapons of the Gods with Nick Redfern. This book is now available. It is a great collection of fascinating stories, and it's a real fun read. And as always, Nick is a very fun writer to read and to comprehend. And it's a good book. So I suggest that you take a look at it. Weapons of the Gods. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I appreciate it, Cliff. Thanks for having me on the show. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. So I hope you enjoyed that with Nick. He just seems to pump out a book every 6 months. He's prolific. And if you ever get a chance to hear him speak, do so, because his presentations are always fun. His slides are excellent, and he presents a good presentation. It's a good talk whenever he's in the area. So I'm hoping to have him out next April in San Francisco to do the New Living Expo, which I work with occasionally. And he's a good, I've heard him on YouTube before. So he does present a good talk. As a reminder, YouTube has this program regularly, and we're up to close to 1 million downloads on that. So that's another avenue. And the other thing I want to mention, and I've talked a little bit about it in the past, is that our website, a unique website for Earth Ancient members, people who are interested in the show, is going to be going up within the next week. After all this talk, it's finally going up, and it's going to be the go-to place for all things ancient Earth and programs that you have, you hear here on the program. So don't check it out. Actually, why don't you let's do this by before the next program. Why don't you go check it out? Let's say by the 6th. It's supposed to be up on the 4th of October. Let's say go to this go to earthancients.com Thursday, October 6th. It should be up. Check it out and register. Make sure you register because I'm going to be offering all kinds of free giveaways. In fact, I just received 4 new Graham Hancock Magicians of the Gods books that I'll be raffling off. So if you register for the website, you may be entered into that raffle and get one of those really cool new books. I have 4 of them to give away. So I'll make that announcement again next week as a reminder. Have a great day, and we will catch you later.